Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Pay for performance. There is a lot of talk these days about investment fees. Regulatory changes are having investors wake up to the hit that fees can deliver to their performance. Sure, you can find lots of low fee options out there, but today we're going to talk about a pay for performance option. And you are your own worst enemy. It's a cliche, but when it comes to investing, it can also be true. New research from Morningstar on the costs of bad behavior and what you can do about them. Then women and money. I'll talk to Doris Bellin. She is the author of Protect Your Purse, Shared Lessons for Women, Avoid Financial Messes, Stop Emotional Bankruptcies, and Take Charge of Your Money. Plus, Interest Piggy. It claims to be a new way to get a good rate on a loan. I'll speak with the founder, but I'm not convinced. Let's get started. Pay for performance. It's a phrase that makes a lot of sense in theory, but in financial services, it's pretty hard to find in practice, unless you're talking about a hedge fund. A company called Transcend is offering a new pay for performance model, saying it will only get paid its full fee after beating the industry benchmark. President Chris Ambridge joins us now to talk about the model and how it's working so far. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
How does it work?
Well, it's really quite simple. We came to the conclusion that the industry for quite a long time has been charging fees. Fees that perhaps are a little exorbitant, fees that eventually will come to take a big bite out of clients' pocket. So we've said that we've been very successful at generating performance historically with the models and the portfolios we've been running. So let's put our money where our mouth is. And so we created a series of pooled funds, which are unique in Canada. Essentially, we charge a very low fee that just covers our costs.
25 basis points.
25
basis points. So about the same as an ETF.
A little less than most equity ETFs. Most equity ETFs are slightly higher, but yeah, correct. So our goal is we're going to try and match the investment risk profile of an ETF, but add value doing it. So by adding value, if we add value, then we charge a fee. If we don't add value, we earn nothing.
You charge 20% of the outperformance.
Correct.
So walk me through an example. If I have $10,000 invested in that fund and you outperform, say you earn an extra $1,000, or is it over the course of a year?
Well, it's over the 20% is based on the annual outperformance, but we charge it quarterly. So it's best to describe it in percentage terms. So say we invest in the Canadian stock fund. The benchmark is the TSX. Recognized total return index. It's the standard for the Canadian industry. If that industry does 10% and we do 9.5%, well, we haven't outperformed. We don't charge anything. So clients are only subject to the 25 basis points or 0.25% annual fee. Now, if we do 12%, well, that means we outperform by 2% relative to the 10. So we would then take 20% of the 2%.
How'd you come up with 20%? Nice round number.
Easy to understand. It's a bit of an industry norm in the hedge fund world, which mm-hmm. we don't want to be equated with, but it's recognized.
That's a 2 and 20 model for hedge funds.
Mm-hmm. Whereas we're 25 and 20.
Right.
But in that world, there is no arbitrary benchmark. It's some figure that someone puts out as being a benchmark, and the performance fees just keep adding and adding up. Whereas in our case, we actually have to deliver something tangible that clients can see.
Are there shades of gray in terms of outperformance? How close can it be if you miss by 0.01%?
We get zero.
You get zero. So you believe that the benchmark index is that accurate and your performance measures are that accurate?
We are. The systems we use on the funds are audited, third parties. We are audited by the OSC. The information is readily available. So from our perspective, what we generate is crystal clear.
It is exceedingly difficult to beat the benchmark index. And we see, I've read the SPIVA data for years, all the data around active management just points out to how hard that actually is. So how are you going to do it? It would seem to me that you may have to take some pretty risky positions.
A lot of people think that. But in actual fact, the way we operate is we've distilled down where we're going to take our risks to a very select area, stock selection. what we do is, recognizing that the underlying fee is very close to ETFs, well, let's match the risk characteristics of the ETFs. So once again, for Canadian stocks, we match the weightings in the sector. So we're not taking a sector investment risk. We're not taking more risky stocks. We match the underlying beta of the benchmark. We match value at risk characteristics, dividend yields, market caps, a raft of financial ratios and characteristics. So we're matching those in the portfolio. What we're doing is, rather than buying all the stocks, we're selectively picking stocks that we believe are going to outperform their benchmark, their peer group, and the relative performance of the market as well.
Now, you talked about Canadian equity and the benchmark associated with that. Are you active in other markets? Are there other funds that you run?
We have six funds in total that are available to Canadians. Canadian, U.S., and international are the base funds that we use those to cobble together three other funds, a North American, a global equity, and something we call total equity, which is spans the world.
How big a leap was this for you? Was this like, okay, everybody, hold hands, we're taking a risk here? Or was it, no, like other people do this, we can, whatever.
No one else does this. The only reason we can do this is because we've been in business for 10 years. We've built up a very stable client base where we offer other services in conjunction with this. So the premise is, we've always wanted to get our fees down. How big a jump can we do? And this is the biggest jump there is, because there's no one else that says, unless I generate something in value that is better than something specific, I'm not getting paid.
What would be your break even in basis points? So you're charging 25 basis points, 0.25% around the cost of a passively managed ETF with very low cost, but you're not a huge organization. I don't know where your office is. Maybe you've got cheap rent or something. Maybe you're in your mom's basement. I don't know. What's the basis point break even? How critical is it for you to outperform?
Well, obviously, we would like to keep the lights on and keep growing. We have been growing at a fairly significant clip over the past 10 years. We've been on Profit magazines.
But do you break even if you outperform 1 in 3 years? Do you break even if you exceed by 0.5%? Like, what are the stakes here?
The stakes are, it's a part of a business. If we basically make nothing on this. So what we're looking at is additional profit to the company, because we have other portfolios that we manage, ETF portfolios and other things. For us, this is a way to expand our profile. Where we've been in the past in terms of giving you real numbers, we've outperformed since these funds have been in existence by a little over 3% per year across the family of funds. For us to meet, make a 1% fee, we have to outperform by 4%. So if you took it, the typical mutual fund out there, typical mutual fund, including advisors, trailers, 2.25. So we're nowhere close to that. If you look at robo fees, we are vastly under that. If you look at the true cost of the robos, from their cost to the MERs to the underperformance. So we are very comfortable with this, and we know that we make money because we continually make money 3 out of 4 quarters.
Do you think more companies will follow you?
No.
Do you want more companies to follow you? Do you think it would be good?
I think it would be good because there's publicity in numbers. People recognize that this is a trend.
It'd be a thing.
It'd be a thing. Like robo-advisors. They've become a thing because they've continued on.
It's relatively new. How long will you let it run for you to see whether or not it's going to work?
Well, we know it works. The funds have been in business for 6 years.
I mean the pay-for-performance model.
Ever. Forever. Our next goal is to get the 25 basis point fee down and be solidly performance only.
And how do you do that?
Get bigger, because the 25 basis points, all it covers is trading, regulatory, you know, standard legal costs, those sort of things. As you get bigger, they are less important. We can reduce the overall cost of the fund.
One last question. What are the challenges of running a business with such a volatile revenue stream, or at least the risk of a volatile revenue stream? Have you already saved for your kids' education? Is your retirement already set? Do you have a trust fund?
I do not have. Well, actually, I do. Well, no, I don't. No, I don't have a trust fund anymore.
You're not from anymore, but you used to have a trust fund?
I used to have a trust.
Oh, Okay.
But that's no longer in business. It's gone into the business to fund the capital to grow.
Right. So you can manage the volatility.
We can manage the volatility. We're very comfortable with what we've done.
Interesting. Chris, thank you for your time. Chris Ambridge is the president of Transcend.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Doris Belland has a lot of life experience, including the loss of her husband after years of dealing with his illness. She decided to put pen to paper and write about what she had learned. Belland is the author of Protect Your Purse, Shared Lessons for Women, Avoid Financial Messes, Stop Emotional Bankruptcies, and Take Charge of Your Money. She joins us now from Ottawa. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Nice to speak with you.
You've had quite a journey so far, including the loss of your husband, Malcolm. Why did you decide to write this book?
It took me a while to do it. I think it was 10 years into it. I started talking. I'm happily remarried. I've had two kids with my my husband, Mark. And I was telling Mark about those experiences, and it was through the stories that I shared with Mark. Mark is the one who said, you need to tell people about this. You need to share these with people. And it dawned on me that maybe, just maybe, some of what I went through, some of the mistakes that I made, might actually be of use to others. And so Mark eventually talked me into writing a blog, and that turned into the book.
Mm. And your focus is on women. I'm interested, as context, what are some things that you would say or are different as it relates to which gender you happen to be from?
You know, I get asked that a lot. Men come up to me and they say, you know, I read your blog all the time and it applies to me as well. And that's absolutely true. There's nothing particularly different except that there happens to be a significant, well, people know about the income gap, but of even greater significance to me is the wealth gap that exists. So the income gap, everybody knows, certainly in Canada, the stats are roughly 20% income gap. So women earn 80 cents to men's dollar. But what surprised me when I started digging into this is that the wealth gap is significantly larger. So women have about 36 to 50 cents of wealth for every dollar that men have. Mm. And that struck me as being very alarming.
Wow.
I saw that in my own business with other women that I helped through credit repair. And I thought, I've got to try to fix this. I've got to try to help women through that. And so I started focusing particularly on women's financial issues.
When Malcolm died, you had a note, but not a real will, not a fully notarized will. What did that mean in terms of the hoops you had to jump through?
Well, in the book, I talk about my fairy godfather. So there was a friend of the family who was a lawyer, and I'd rather not get him into trouble because he waved his magic wand and helped me out with that. He helped to notarize that, let's just put it that way. So for me, when it dawned on me that I did not have a valid will, all of a sudden I realized that there were some accounts that would be frozen simply because I no longer had access to them, or certainly not legally. It meant that I couldn't deal with Malcolm's investments because people ask you for a copy of the will. They want a copy of the death certificate. So I realized in a big hurry, at a time when I was already dealing with a lot of stuff, that this could make my life very, very difficult. And then this person stepped up, helped me out, and it really saved my backside at that time.
Mm. Divorce is something that so many couples deal with. Your focus on it in this context is from a woman's perspective, which I think is great, given what your interest is in particular. Diana's story is a cautionary tale. How would you summarize that, and what would be the lesson that you would put out there for women?
So I think the issue for a lot of the stories that I talk about in the book are composites. So I have to say that first and foremost. I'm trying to remember now, Diana, because I've given them all fake names. I know their real names to actually flip through. So just give me one.
Her husband, Jeff, had a horrible time in his past, and there was infidelity, and she had to move out of the house. It was really just one of those ones.
Yes,
I wanted to bake her a lasagna and go give her a hug.
Yeah, and this is someone, so thank you. This is someone who I had no idea. I know this person. and had no idea about her background. When she found out what I was doing, she basically poured me a glass of wine, said, sit down, shut up, and listen. And then told me this story where she married someone who had had a very violent background. He wasn't violent, but he saw extreme violence in his family. There was a death. One parent was killed by the other. And it was just, it was horrific. He had seemed to be over it, but obviously it was not. The old ghost came back to haunt him. And in short, she trusted him implicitly. She ended up signing loan documents. She had no idea that they were loan documents. Like, she just trusted him. He said, oh, this is for our house, sign here. And she ended up signing a lot of stuff away, mm-hmm. ended up homeless when he kept the home. It was an absolutely horrific experience for her.
What's your lesson for people whose circumstances, even if they do end up going through that process, are probably, you know, less dramatic, but still very challenging in their own right?
So I think prevention is, I think, one of the biggest things that comes out of this. So there are two big lessons. Not one of the women, and I make this point over and over again in the book, no one, whether it was death or divorce, nobody saw it coming. And I think it's important because we all have a little bit of moment where we think we're bulletproof, where, and this happens a lot where I talk to people and they say, oh my gosh, well, thank God my husband's in great shape, or I'm in great shape, or our marriage is in great shape. So I think there's a little bit of that feeling of invulnerability. So the one lesson is, don't assume that something like this can't happen to you. The second thing is, just be very careful about ensuring that you have protective documents in place. So divorce is very different from death, obviously. Life insurance is not going to do a thing for you if you get divorced. It will make all the difference in the world if you experience a death. Divorce is more about making sure that you know exactly what the situation is financially. And I talk about a beaver cleaver-like distribution of tasks back in the 50s, where the ladies used to take care of the household tasks and the men used to take care of the money and the investing. We can't afford to do that any longer, both because of divorce, but also because women end up being the financial managers in the household.
Mm. If only because they tend to live longer, right? Like, where's my husband? Well, it's up to me. Now, you do have a lighter chapter on men and tools, where you really advocate that women learn the basics. I mean, that tell us why you feel so strongly about that.
Well, after Malcolm died, I ended up with a house that was in desperate need of repairs. And of course, the rule is that the moment your husband disappears or dies, that's when everything's going to break. And, you know, that's exactly what happened to me. Stuff needed repairing. So now you're having to deal with stuff. And I was actually fairly well-versed in repairs. I'd had to be when he was ill. I'm the one who took up the hammer and started swinging it. So it's not like I had no knowledge. And yet, I still found myself in a heck of a pickle when all of a sudden the furnace stops working in the dead of winter on one of the coldest nights ever. And you start thinking, oh, my God, and it's a holiday. Everybody's closed. Nobody can help you. What do you do? You get a record snowfall that year, of course. What do you do? How do you work the snowblower? We lived on an acreage and a massive, massive driveway, which we thought was the coolest thing when we bought it. Well, not so cool if you're having to figure out how the snowblower works and you can't. You know, you can't get your car out of the driveway. So there are some basic things. And I have two daughters now, and I insist that they have a working knowledge of the basics of a home, the basics of a car, so that they are not entirely vulnerable if they find themselves alone or when they find themselves alone.
Doris, I thank you for your time. You tell some really compelling stories and have some great insight for people. We appreciate you taking some of your time with us.
My pleasure, Bruce.
Doris Belland is the author of Protect Your Purse. Well, stay with us. Coming up later on Moolala, Chris Ambridge answers the Moolala questionnaire. But next, bad behavior, yours. When it comes to your investment decisions, a new report from Morningstar points out the problems and proposes a plan. Follow me at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry on Facebook. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
This is Moolala, Money Made Simple on Sirius XM. I'm Bruce Ellery. Investors often confuse action with progress. That's one of the insights coming out of a new report from Morningstar on Canadian investor behavior. Christopher Davis is the report's author. He joins us now to talk about these findings. Hello there.
Hi there.
Last 10 years, the average Canadian diversified equity fund returned almost 4.4%. The average investor, slightly under 3% annually over the decade, which is a gap of about 1.4 percentage points. This is a problem. Why?
Well, you know, if you're not doing as well as your funds are doing, you're leaving a lot of money on the table. Over a 10-year period, if you had a $100,000 investment at the beginning of the period, the gap there would cost you about $20,000 over 10 years. And so if you were to magnify that over a 30-year period, let's say, I mean, $20,000 is real money, but, you know, imagine the toll that bad behavior takes on your portfolio over the long haul.
Yeah, compounding year over year. Now, often we talk about fees and the challenge that investors have when they pay a lot on a mutual fund MER versus if they did it with a lower cost option. This is not what we're talking about, though. We're talking about bad investor behavior and a number of reasons that you assert, including this quote that I said off the top: investors often confuse action with progress. What do you mean?
Well, you know, a lot of investors think if they just sit and hold their investments, or they patiently, you know, and add a certain set amount to their portfolios every single month, that's kind of boring, that, you know, they're not being active enough, they're not taking advantage of opportunities. If they meet with their advisor every single quarter or month or year, and they see the advisor hasn't done a whole lot, they might think, oh, well, my advisor is lazy, not doing his or her job, but that may not really be the case. So a lot of action is just predicated on this notion that if you have to do something in order to add value, and often action in investing, because it costs money to trade, because people are driven by emotions, often action leads you to make big mistakes.
Right, right. So it's not the same thing as with a cleaning person. They need to be taking actions to clean your house regularly. But
yeah.
When it comes to your portfolio, you ran the numbers on this do-nothing portfolio. What were some of the more nuanced findings there?
Well, you know, we found that investors that did nothing at all, they just invested and sat there, often did better than the fund itself. In Canada, we actually found weaker findings with the do-nothing portfolio versus other markets. So, you know, maybe it's not conclusive. Maybe in some cases, you know, investors should think about whether their portfolios need a house cleaning. You know, not all action is unproductive.
Right. Dollar cost averaging is your friend, as you say. Buy every month. Sometimes the price is going to be high. Sometimes it's going to be low. That theory has been around for a very long time. You have an example in your report that you include that references Australia. Can you give us the basics there on what you infer from what happens with their superannuation funds?
Yeah, their superannuation funds are funds that are specifically designed for these compulsory retirement plans. So, you know, just like you may have you know, some kind of workplace pension plan that is voluntary. Well, in Australia, that's mandatory. So everybody in the country is a dollar cost averager. And, you know, the superannuation funds, because they're designed just for these retirement plans, are, you know, essentially a great example of what happens when everybody dollar cost averages. And, you know, across time periods, across different kinds of funds, investors actually did better than their funds. Mm-hmm. You know, over the long haul. And so I think that really is a testament to the power of dollar cost averaging. You mentioned this idea has been around for a long time. And I guess there is a reason why it has been around for a long time. It's time tested, it's enforced discipline. And, you know, most of us are too busy to manage our investments, you know, every single day or even every single month. And so, you know, going on autopilot removes the emotion from the equation.
What did you learn about volatility?
Well, you know, we generally found, you know, that the more volatile the fund, the less well investors are able to use it. And, you know, so, you know, funds that are really volatile, investors tend to buy in, you know, after they've had a really great run. So investors like upside volatility. They love it. You know, nobody is unhappy when their fund is up 30% in a year. But highly volatile.
They wouldn't, probably wouldn't even call it volatility. They would just call it like, I am so smart.
Right.
I chose the best fund ever.
Yeah, exactly. But investors really hate downside volatility. So what they end up doing is they buy after the fund has had a good run, and you know, when the funds get into trouble, they sell. They don't like the downside volatility. You know, so these funds tend to have worse investor returns.
Know thyself and thy funds is one other phrase here, and certainly some self-awareness is important. But I find people often they mismanage the risk component because sometimes they have the emotional risk trump everything. It trumps the practical risk, the risk that they can actually withstand and maybe should be able to withstand because it's going to be helpful to the return over time. How do you reconcile those two things?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a tricky one. I kind of sometimes find the opposite. Investors think they can handle a huge loss, and they really can't. I think there's maybe, you know, finding that middle ground and try to straddle the difference between what you should be able to handle given your age and your risk tolerance and what you can actually handle, you know, because there's often a gap there. And I do think that investors would be wise to think about, you know, what they can handle. If, you know, they're a 30-year-old investor, they can handle a lot of exposure to equities. So, you know, that investor shouldn't be too scared or, you know, frightened by the merest whiff of volatility.
Yeah, because I remember in 2008 when the markets were cratering and people were obviously very, very concerned. But for those, I'm in my 40s. Back then I would have been in, I guess, in my mid-30s. Didn't futz me in the least. It's totally fine. Now I've been covering this for couple of decades, so I had the perspective. But practically, that decline, as horrific as it was immaterial to a 35-year-old saving for retirement.
Yeah, and so I think, and, you know, in that case, really doing nothing or sticking to your long-term plan, you know, would be the best thing to do. And I guess one of the problems that investors have is their risk tolerance changes based on what the market environment is. So if you would have asked those investors in 2006 and 2007, they would have been maybe fine with risk because they've had several years of really great returns. You ask them in 2009, oh, I can't handle any risk
right,
at all.
Right.
So that's why I think tethering back to what your actual time horizon is a great reality check.
One last question here. We will, in all likelihood, see a market pullback at some point in the future. I mean, inevitably, it's going to happen at some point in our lifetimes. But after a decade of stock market growth, it's going to happen who knows where. Fundamentals aside, it's going to happen at some point. What advice would you have for investors now, while they can see things clearly, while markets are, you know, hovering at these record levels? What would be the number one thing that you would have them keep in their heads and their hearts?
Well, I mean, I think maybe it's a good time to, you know, reexamine their overall asset allocation, you know, make sure it's suitable for their needs going forward. If they haven't rebalanced their portfolio back to their original plan, you know, they may have outsized exposure to stocks because stocks have been on this multi-year run.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe it's time to cut it back a bit. So, you know, when you have that inevitable turbulence, it'll be just less jarring because your portfolio will be, you know, less exposed
right.
to it. But generally, if you have a good plan, just stick with it.
Stick with it. Christopher, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having
appreciate
me.
It, appreciate it. Christopher Davis is with Morningstar. Coming up, an action checklist to help you get a handle on your money. Author Doris Bland will be here with some specific steps you can take to get a handle on your money. And later, Interest Piggy. Will it help you find a better rate on your loan? You can check out more on Moolala either on the web, moolala.ca, or in one of my books. Second one is called The Moolala Guide to Rocking Your RRSP. It's available online, anywhere you shop for books. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I was at a conference recently, and one of the speakers said something really practical and really controversial. She said, I don't care what you think, I don't care what you feel, I care what you do. So what do you do when it comes to your money? Doris Belland is the author of Protect Your Purse, Shared Lessons for Women. And she has what she calls an action checklist. Doris, why did you decide we needed a checklist? Other than the fact that I am a big fan of a checklist. Are you a big fan of checklists?
I absolutely am.
Love
them. I buy them. Yeah.
Love them. So why did you decide we needed one when it came to money?
Because at the end of the book, when you go through, there are all these lessons that I've learned, all the stuff that I tell you to do. And I know perfectly well when we get to the end of it, people will say, oh my gosh, that was super interesting, and close the book. And that's the end of that, right? The point that I wanted to make is it's not enough to know information. You actually have to do something. And I wanted to make it as easy as possible for people to succeed. So I said, here are the basics you need to protect yourself.
I'm going to go in reverse order, starting with number 9,
yep.
Schedule thinking time. First, why? And second, how? Do you mean actually in your calendar? There's a thing that says thinking time on Friday at 2?
No, it's Monday morning, first thing, before I take a call, turn on my emails, do anything. I have thinking time every single Monday for half an hour. I do not respond to anything, and I think. And the reason is that I have seen in my own experience, in all of the women that I've interviewed and the people I've seen professionally, that we tend to go through life focused on the trees in our life instead of the forest. And so we react to all the fires, the stuff that's going on. Next thing you know, 10 years have passed and you wonder, how on earth did I get here? And that's because we're not making conscious, deliberate choices. We're in reactionary mode. And that can have grave consequences, as it did for me in my own story. And I realized that so much of the pain that I experienced could have been prevented if I had simply taken regular moments to sit down, shut things down, and ask myself some basic questions like, are you even in the right forest to begin with? Are you doing what you should be doing? Are you protected? What's your source of income? A bunch of very simple questions would have changed my world.
Another action, book time for girlfriends.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Because I interviewed 38 women for my book, and every single one of them said, all of your relationships are important, your family are important, male relationships as well, but it is your girlfriends from a woman's perspective. It is your girlfriends who are going to see you through the thick of the nasty stuff that happens in your life. It is so important to foster those relationships. I did not. My husband, Malcolm, my first husband, I was with him for 9.5 years. And in that time, it was in and out of oncology wards. And so I lost track of a lot of girlfriends. And at the end, I realized that was a mistake, because the people who did stick around, who were my biggest support, were my girlfriends. And you realize that's invaluable. And that was borne out by the 38 women that I spoke to as well.
How do you build those relationships in a way that provides that support and isn't just the, you know, the important discourse around kids and family and whatever, but that can progress to something that's deeper and more meaningful?
You know, I think, first of all, regular exposure. So just taking time out to go laugh with the ladies, right? So I have a book club, 8 ladies. I love those women. We sit down, we laugh, we talk about everything. And I know that a couple of those ladies would be there for me regardless what happens. And then I think it's time alone with them, one-on-one. I was speaking with a friend of mine in Washington just this morning, and we were talking about what is it that kept our relationship so strong. And it's because we regularly took time to go for walks, just her and I, do stuff alone and talk about real stuff, the kind of stuff that you tend not to talk about when you're in a group dynamic.
Mm.
Both are important.
Another item on your action checklist is to discuss finances with your spouse. What are the topics in particular that would be included in that discussion?
Well, I suggest going over debts, assets, and investments. So the debts, I think everybody tends to be aware of what that is. The biggest issue that I've seen is that women, by and large, or women, I should say, the demographic over 35, so kind of the 30 to 55-year-old range, women tend not to get as involved in investments as men. And one of the things I've been doing as I talk to women is asking them, so who does what? And by and large, women do not get involved heavily in the investing side of things. That's a real problem, because if for any reason something happens to your husband, an illness, death, divorce, now you're in charge of the whole tamale. Well, you have to know what you've got in the first place. And it's not enough just to know what they are. You need to understand what they are so that you know how to deal with them if all of a sudden you become the caretaker of all the finances.
Mm. We've got time for one more action item here. Grow your savings while tackling debt. How do you do the two at the same time?
Well, so you look at the resources that you have and you take a look at what are your most corrosive debts. So a credit card debt is by far and away the most corrosive debt there is. So you tackle that. But I argue that it's important to put some money aside, even if it's only $5, $10, and build up that savings so that you can build that muscle. Saving is like a muscle. It's a habit. You have to reinforce that to make sure that that keeps going the moment you finish off paying off your debts. Otherwise, the second you do that, and I have seen this over and over again professionally, people say, oh, thank God that debt's done. And then they go dig themselves another hole. Do the savings and realize the importance of that savings. Watch it build, and it can buoy you to decide, hey, I want to do more of this. I can do it.
Some great ideas here. Complete your will, review your insurance, tackle investing. Doris, thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
My pleasure.
Doris Belland is the author of Protect Your Purse, Shared Lessons for Women, Avoid Financial Messes, Stop Emotional Bankruptcies, and Take Charge of Your Money. Coming up, there are lots of sites on the internet that promise to help you find the best rate on a loan or on a GIC. I'll talk to the founder of one called Interest Piggy to see if it offers anything new. You can subscribe to the podcast version of the show on iTunes. Head on over and set that up. But don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I'm Bruce Ellery. You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple on Sirius XM. Bargain hunters love the internet. And when it comes to financial products, there are already lots of websites promising to help you find the best deal. There's a new one called Interest Piggy, and it calls itself an interest rate marketplace. Manny Candola is the company's founder, and he joins us now. Hello there.
Hello there, Bruce.
So how does Interest Piggy work?
Okay. So Interest Piggy, what we do is we actually create online competitions for consumers' businesses. So Interest Piggy is a free online marketplace that helps consumers find those best interest rates through a competitive bidding process. And through that process, they get access to top-rated providers for mortgages, loans, GICs, and savings accounts. And so consumers simply plug in their requirements, invite their banks to compete, and they watch as financial providers bid for their business.
And so how would this differ from a Rate Hub or a Lowest Rates or any of those other comparison sites out there?
Sure. So I think a core difference is that those rate comparison sites are limited to advertised rates. So they generate their computer-generated rates whenever you are shopping. With ours, it's the providers, because it's an open competition and the providers are live, the providers can actually see the other offers that are being presented to the consumer. And therefore, we feel that as soon as they have that visibility, they'll come in with a more competitive rate.
Now, interest rates are so low, regardless of whether or not you're trying to get a mortgage or trying to earn a little bit on a GIC. How much competition mm-hmm. is there really these days?
Sure. So there's from hearing from stories from user focus groups as well as family and friends, there seems to still be a very vast difference in what I can get and versus what my neighbor can get, even though some of our financial situations should be the same. So there is still, you know, there's a bit of margin there. And there's certainly some discretion that financial providers have. And also what we're seeing is because although Bank of Canada is not there's not too much exciting news on the interest rates, there we already are in a market where rates are rising. So because of those rising interest rates, certain banks have already taken positions on raising their rates. That as soon as more of the rates raise, you'll have more of a spread to be able to compete with
who, it. Who are the lenders for whom this is of interest? Because I can imagine the big banks are pretty happy to focus on channels that they control versus getting into some that are a little more entrepreneurial, a little off the beaten mm-hmm. path. Who's playing the game?
Okay, so we actually are attracting all tiers. And when I mention that, that's big banks. Credit unions, brokers for mortgages, and there's various size and types of brokers for the for mortgages. And so we're attracting like all of those different tiers, and also this new bucket called alternative lenders. FinTech is certainly a hot topic, and it's creating multiple channels to do so. So it's been a good mixed bag for us. And the reason being is we help providers accelerate the sales cycle quite drastically using our process. So financial providers, you know, they can see the efficiency in the sales cycle and bidding online and just getting connected with consumers that want to be connected with them to finalize the deal. So because of that process, it's definitely kind of a key thing for all. All providers see the value in it.
How long have you been live?
We've been live now since May 24th. So the last Bank of Canada interest rate last week. So just under a week.
Just under a week. Now, so my experience was not super positive as I was trying it out. So I first could not get any quotes on the GICs that I was hoping for. And I noticed there are a bunch of typos on the site. So I'm going to cut you some slack because you're still relatively new to the game here. But I do want to ask you about the question of credibility, because one of the big challenges that fintechs have is that consumers are simply so used to dealing with their big banks that it takes something more for them to trust someone who isn't entrenched. How do you overcome that, especially if functionality wise, it doesn't feel like you were quite ready to debut?
Oh, okay. We've certainly got an active development team that's running 24/7, looking at all of those pieces and fixing them as we go. We're certainly responsive. As far as credibility is concerned, the growth in the numbers and what we do in the next few months is certainly going to help us with our credibility piece. We've certainly had a lot of influential media kind of starting to cover us. So they like the concept, and also some of the providers that we have on board, they've got some credible brand names too. But what I would suggest is, from the credibility perspective, the consumer doesn't necessarily need to rely on our provider network. They can simply use the tool and invite existing providers that they work with. And use the platform as simply a technology tool that they use to create an open competition for their business.
How does Interest Piggy make its money?
So we're a lead generation tool. So we've got so that's our core primary revenue. Is as soon as we match consumers to providers, providers give us a fee for that hot lead, hot fresh lead that we give them. We also we're collecting a lot of data, and we do things through avatars, and we've got some social media links, etc., with profiles, and all of that makes some really interesting data. And plus, providers are also finding that they can very specifically target. With all of that platform, there's also a SaaS fee that we charge providers, so a gold, silver, and a bronze. Depending on their levels, they get different levels of access to market data.
One thing that surprised me when I was going through the loan part, so I played around with the GIC and with the loan part, is that you were asking the user to self-report on credit score. Mm-hmm. Can you really get an accurate quote on a loan without doing the credit check, without having the actual inquiry?
Yeah, so the key thing here is that we don't establish commitments online. So the consumer is not obliged to commit, nor is the provider. What we try to do is we give enough information here that allows an apples-to-apples comparison and allows the provider to actually say, okay, if these factors are all true, then this would be my rate. And it would be like when you go to a provider, if you do a pre-approval for a mortgage, they give you a discussion paper or a term sheet.
Yep.
We've essentially automated that process, and we take it to that far to say, if all of this information is correct, we will give you this rate. So we do expect providers, and they're going to anyway, to go ahead and start processing a full application. And if there's anything that's drastically changed, well, that will be discussed and talked about. At least the consumer knows that they're dealing with a competitive provider.
Right. I'd be surprised if very many of your competitor or very many of your consumers would have any idea what their credit score actually is. But I could be wrong. Manny, I wish we had more time. Thank you for giving us some of yours today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Manny Condola is the founder of Interest Piggy. the Moolala Questionnaire, series of questions about money, a little bit about life. I'm going to ask Chris Ambridge, the president of Transcend, a company offering a pay-for-performance model, which I think is exciting and ludicrous in the same breath. Chris, the first thing that comes into your mind, are you ready?
Absolutely.
Okay. How would you describe your money personality?
Conservative with a touch of wildness.
Ooh, okay. Where's the wildness? Where does that come from?
Anybody that ever goes into business has to be a little wild, a little crazy, because the threats of going under and losing everything or having to start again, it requires it. You need that little either spark of genius or Robin Williams craziness.
Mm.
Unfortunately, that's the way it is. And if you're going to succeed, there needs to be a little bit more of the craziness, because everything can go haywire in any particular moment, and all you can do is put out the fire and move on to the next day.
Looking back over your life, who was the most influential figure for you in terms of how you think about and how you manage your own money?
It depends who you ask, really.
Well, I'm asking you.
You're asking me.
I'm asking you.
Everybody that I know says I remind them of some mythical relative called Uncle Bill, who was the cheapest person alive, apparently.
But I don't think I'm true. Cheap. You don't actually have an Uncle Bill?
I don't think I do, but frugal, save my money, and then when I do need to spend it, then I'll go out and squander it.
What is your guiltiest spending pleasure?
Whew. I think I've done it already. I traveled around the world for years, go on spontaneous trips. You got to go and buy something in a liquor store. Well, go and do it. So right now, I think just trying to stay sane in this business we're building.
Right. When do you plan to retire, and what will you do?
I don't really plan to ever retire.
I knew you were going to say that. I knew you were going to say that. Okay, so you're not going to – will you manage down your workload and manage up your life of leisure?
I'm doing that to a certain degree. You know, I'm finding other things to do besides work. It's taken a little
knitting?
Bit of one. No, knitting I did as a kid.
So oh, you did? That, okay, oh, good. Well, at least it's in your past.
Yes, it's there.
What was your worst financial mistake?
This business that we started is the third that I've done. So the other two, well, wonderful learning experiences, were very poor financially.
Uh-huh.
The second one in particular took a nice little bite out of my retirement savings.
Ooh, what happened?
It just didn't grow as fast as you wanted. You know, as you grow, as you try different things, you start off very simple. Then you start adding more elaborate, more costs, more goals. And when it didn't work out, well, it was a lovely working and learning experience, but the bank account was a little dry and dusty at the end of the day.
If you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, what would it be?
I'd get people to actually read and learn something. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of people out there, it's not their primary concern. It's not their primary focus of life. And as a result, they just don't pay a lot of attention to their finances.
So a supplementary, what do you think is the most important lesson they would need to learn? Or what is the most important book aside from my two books that they should read? Oh, was that a plug? Oops, that was the plug. Yes, it was.
So I should plug another book or just stick to yours?
You can plug another book. You don't have to stick with mine. But what should people learn? And I say that because there's so much out there. I mean, I read it. You read it. We work in this business. I have an hour-long show every single week. Most people are never going to do that. So if you were to triage, for some people, triage the pain of what it's going to be to learn something that they may not be interested in learning, where would you point them?
Well, you can go to the very rudimentary books, the Barber book?
The Wealthy Barber, yeah.
It's a great starting point. I think just read the popular press, listen to shows like this, obviously. You know, what you really look at is how do you desensitize yourself to the news, you know, the current fad or the current worry. All that's going to do is, you know, churn up your stomach and make you want to do something that's probably bad for you at the end of the day. Most people, all they have to do is take a big breath, calm down, it's going to work out at the end of the
day. I thought you were going to do like a little hand signal for a toke of some ganja
or something.
But you didn't do that. This is radio. He really didn't do that, everybody.
No,
he was just making a point. Chris, thank you very much for this.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. Chris Ambridge is the president of Transcend, and he's on the show this week because he's got a new pay-for-performance model, which is interesting and contrarian. That is our program for today. Thank you very much for joining us. To listen to past episodes, you can go to iTunes. They are sitting on iTunes. You can also go to moolala.ca. And if you click on the podcast button, you can not only listen to the full podcast, but you can also listen to individual segments. So if there's one that you've missed that you want to target in on, you can do that. You can also set up the subscription so that each new episode just shows up at your iPhone or your iPad. Any questions or comments you have, you can send them via email to ask@moolala.ca. You can reach out on Twitter @BruceSelry or Facebook, Bruce Selry Moolala. Thank you very much for listening and have a great day.